that the fallacy of objectification. Interesting word. Ob is what is it, outer or from? From. Well, it's I still got to work this, the Latin out, because the Latin dictionary is a mess on translation from the English or Germanic. Ob is translated as from. Ject, push. Ficca or fic, make. Object making, or push out making. In English, I mean, we've anglicized the usage. You know what an object is. It's out there. But the interesting thing about this one is that it's been, so to speak, jettisoned or ejected or launched or thrown out there and somehow made into something real. The other word that you will use frequently is projection. Projection. Pro for throw, and therefore throw out of. But anyway, that's an aside. These are three fallacies, then, which have done unceasing and incalculable mischief, I think, in dealing with some rather major practical problems. In the case of healing, how major and practical can you get? And I think that enormous mischief has been created by those three big mistakes.
No? Foreign tongue,
do
you mean like adding all the word stuff that we've been talking
about before? Foreign tongue is Greek, for instance.
Okay.
Sanskrit. Not so foreign. Latin. Latin is still a foreign tongue.
Making up words for supposedly
received sentences. Yeah, what you do is you, let's say there's something you want to give a name, so you look in a book on Greek and say, hey, that looks good. You paste that name on that thing. Of course, if it's usually not something that you can see, but something you've imagined. And so you put this Greek word on this imaginary thing, and now you have objectified it, made an object of it, a reality of it. I'll talk about this idea, this fallacy, at length. This is what I'm going to be talking about for quite a while now. It's the fallacy of objectification, or you might call it foreignization. I will call it reification. That in philosophy, that's the word, reification. You reify things, make them real. That too. Consider the word Gestalt. Okay, it's foreign tongue. It's Germanic, like English, but still very difficult to find agreement on how that is translated into English. So you show any foreignization is going to lead to confusion.
But wouldn't any science have their own terminology? And if you choose to use a descriptive term,
own new words. And since the hard sciences, so-called, developed before the soft sciences, the people in the soft sciences, the so-called behavioral sciences, one of which is healing, or the Latins call it medicine, wanting to be, quote, scientific, and that, by the way, we're going to have to look at that word very carefully because it has so much punch, and yet is not understood. You can get a big argument. Even a fight with people who disagree about what that particular word refers to. My son, for instance, who's a computer scientist, says that psychology and sociology and anthropology are not sciences. I mean, these are trivial endeavors. For my son, a computer scientist, these so-called behavioral sciences are trivial and unimportant and scarcely scientific. I do agree with it. Depending, you know, when you see what this word, where it came from, you may agree with him on that too. Although the computer science is not all that swift either. Where was I? Okay, that's the thesis. That's what I'm putting it out, thesis, that the mischief, the source of the mischief are these two fallacies in foreign language. And because these two fallacies are wrapped in alien words, you don't even know that you're committing those fallacies. Yeah. Ray was pointing out something. Korsivsky used it. Any of you ever heard of Alfred Korsivsky? He published a book in 1950, thereabout, 49, 47, I don't know. Science and Sanity. He was a Polish dilettante, interested in language. It made quite a splash at the time. A few people read it, and it launched the idea of general semantics. I never did figure out what the general was, but the semantics finally figured out what that was. That's Greek for meaning. Sema is Greek for meaning. But he said some rather important things, and some of which I will point out today. But among these important things he said was that he was talking about children. And Ray Chouinard was pointing out how he had that experience with a little kid recently. The little kid says, "What's that?" And Ray says, "Well, that's a dodo bird. That's a Zabuducci." And the kid said, "Oh." Indicating that human beings are own that which they can name. If you can name it, then you own it. It's now an object in your world. The Bible says, in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was good. That seems to be human nature, to be an animal that names things. And once they're named, now they're real, and they're not going to go away, and sooner or later we can begin to understand them. But if they don't have a name, then they are unreal, and never understand them. But watch that with kids. All they're asking, much of the time, especially when they're young, is, what's the name of that? They're not asking you for a long description of how the thing came into being and what sorts of behavior it begins, it engages in. For instance, the Maryland Bay students say that, tell the story of a little kid who says, what's that? And the kid's mother says, the father, I think. I said, well, that's a penguin. And then he launched into a long, long declension on how they're born, what they do, how they die, where they came from, what class they're in, and so on and so forth. And after this long, long tirade, the little kid says, well, that's more than I wanted to know about penguins. The little kid wanted to know the names. That would have been satisfying the kid. Just give it a name, and later on, we'll find out about this penguin. So in the department, that's been a saying used frequently. Well, that's more than I wanted to know about penguins. When you ask somebody a question and they give you a long tirade like I give, it may well be that I'm going to say a lot of things, a lot more than you want to know about words. Now, by objectifying something, and I'll try to show how giving it an alien name, putting an alien word on it, labeling an alien something a foreign, other, tends to make this named thing an entity, which, and then it now becomes another part. So that by objectifying things, one makes them particles, or part and parcel of wholes. So that this, the fallacy of objectification seems to fall into the elementalistic trap. If you make it an entity, now that entity can do what other entities do, all sorts of things. So another word for this is that you can entify things by giving them a word that doesn't mean anything to people. Now it's not, kind of makes it very solid, very real, that makes them exist. And then parenthetically, now we can find out what they do. The mind is probably the worst objectification that ever occurred in the history of Western philosophy. That mind became objectified, or entified, reified, and therefore created as an entity, and now the task became that of figuring out, well, what does this thing do? What is a penguin? Now we have a name for it, mind. What does it do? And as you well know, you can find countless books, and countless articles that tell you what wonderful things the mind as an entity can do. Fantastic things. Turns out that the mind can do everything that a human being can do. And somewhere you're going to find somebody saying the mind has all of those capabilities that you find in human beings. And so was born the homunculus, the idea of the homunculus, the little man inside that has all of the attributes, characteristics, and properties of the man housing the little man inside. Incidentally, and in passing, that is the objectification fallacy that I believe is the source of what is called in philosophy begging the question. You have a question that you ask, a danger. You want an answer. If the question you ask contains its own answer, then you have said, you have begged the question. You've answered your own question by the way you formed it. So it's like sweeping dirt under the rug. You ask, what does, if you say, what does the mind do? That begs the question that you're trying to ask. You ask the question, what does the mind do? How does it function? What kinds of activities does it engage in? Presupposes that it is such that it can behave, it can act, it can do things. So you have begged the very question that you've asked. So this fallacy is a source of, I think, most questions that are begged by the way they're put, by identifying or reifying or making real things that aren't real, aren't objects. And I will talk at length on what is real and what is not real. What is an object and what is not an object. Because that is what a healer has got to learn how to do, is to separate the things that are real from those things that aren't. And know when a sentence is talking about something real as over against something that's not real.
So
that
you're saying the third fallacy establishes a false premise that is then acted upon as if it were true.
Yeah. Well, it assumes something unwittingly, begging the question and say, logicians call it the tacit assumption. Tacit. It's not a stated assumption. It's the way you framed your sentence had an assumption that went along with it you don't even know you made. And back to the mind again. What does the mind do? Or if you want to fragment the mind, let's say, what does the ego do? What sort of functions does the ego have? Presupposes that the ego is such a thing that it can have functions. Yeah.
It seems to me that this would be similar to what nominalism in the history of philosophy tried to do to counter the dualism or idealism that was prevalent at the time. That the existence is in the name, or what is significant is naming the objects to give, and that gives an existence.
That's right. That's, in fact, you could call this the fallacy of nominalizing. In other words, you use a noun. You say that's a thing. You nounify it. Not nomen, nomen is to name. To name is to create. Yeah, exactly. So this, there's another name for it, the fallacy of nominalizing. Nominalizing, reifying, objectifying, foreignizing. Well, foreignizing is a little different idea. You see, if a person used ordinary Germanic English and plastering labels on these imaginary things like egos, minds, ids, mechanisms. If you just used ordinary Germanic English, nobody would listen to you. You wouldn't get anybody's attention, I guess. Back to the history of this, the people in the soft sciences emulated the people in the hard sciences. The people in the hard sciences, and even in the semi-hard, that is the life sciences, say botany and zoology, used the Greek mainly to name the plants and animals that they were studying. Now, why they did that, I suppose, you know, an educated person in the 19th century was a person who had studied Greek and Latin, and that was their major study. So when they went to work, I suppose they had to use the stuff that they learned, and in the trivium. We'll never know why they did it, but we can speculate that maybe it had something to do with their training and also emulating those who were making headway in the physical sciences. Notice that I will not be talking about thinking. I'll be talking about talking. I will not be talking about thinking. Why do I refuse to talk about thinking? There isn't any way to see it. Put it very bluntly. You can't see thinking, ever. Thinking is an imaginary sort of thing. Since it's an imaginary sort of thing, there's no anything we can do to observe it, watch it. So I don't see much point in talking about it. But I do see a lot of point about talking about talking. Because talking we can see. You, for instance, see me talking now. Okay, what about words? Two kinds of words. One sort of word are commands or directives. For instance, I say, shut up. That's a command. Now, you may not obey it, but that's the sort of the sentence I'm saying. I might say, hey, what time is it? That's a command to tell me what time it is. You still may not obey my command, my directive, but that doesn't change its nature. The linguists call it a performative. That is to say, the positivists. Performative. The performative sentence is one where you are told to perform something, some kind of behavior. Tell me what time it is. Get out. Drop dead. Get lost. Come here. These are all performatives. Yeah. Of course. Question is a command to say something. For instance, I say, are you going to empty the ashtray? Interrogative. My command is to tell me whether or not you're going to empty the ashtray. So all questions, all interrogatives, punctuation. They're punctuated. I make my move, now it's your move. So anything that's punctuated with an exclamation point or a question mark is by definition a directive or a performative. I'm not going to talk about this kind of language. That's not the issue. The other kind, and as far as I can figure it out, these are the only other kind of sentence that you can utter, is the informative. Sentence where I say it's 4:57:03 time. That's an informative sentence. I'm not telling you to do something. I'm informing you. I'm giving you a message. What you do about it is your problem, not mine. But what you do about my command is my problem. If you don't obey me, then I say something bad to you or kick you or something, or punish you by leaving, or I have all sorts of things, depending upon my nature, how I'm going to get even with you if you don't obey me. But if I inform you, I don't ask you to tell me whether you understand or not. If I inform you, hey, it's 4:57:46, is that right? Okay, the is that right sentence appended to my informative is a performative. Now you are supposed to say, yes, it's right, or no, it's wrong. I've commanded you. But don't. So I say, the time is X, right? Okay, there's one sentence. But actually, it's two sentences. This is an informative, and that's a performative. And I'm not going to be talking about that. So I realize you can get an informative and a performative in one sentence, one string, with a period on the end, with punctuated it, with a stop on the end. I realize that, but don't confuse performatives with informatives. It's very important. Now I'm going to talk about informatives. First, there are decisive, and I'm going to keep changing these words, but for my purposes right now, I want to say that they're, first of all, decisive informatives. They're decisive. They're clear cut. There's nothing left out about them. There, I'm going to say absolute. Independent. Don't depend on anything. All there. And the second kind is indecisive. To put it negatively, that's negative. Not decisive. Indecisive. There are indecisives and decisives. These are relative, relational, dependent. I'm going to also say contingent. I'll talk about these shortly. Right now, I want to trot out the different kinds of informative sentences that a person can say to other people. The third kind is I choose to call the imaginary, the imaginaries, dreams, fantasies, stuff you have in your head. And the fourth one, I choose to call visibles. I find it interesting that I speak Latin. This is all Latin. Somehow, the Germanic doesn't have it when you're talking about complicated things. More and more, I notice people will lapse into Latin when they want to talk about something complicated. And I don't There it is, big as Latin. Even absolute is Latin, independent is Latin. Relative is Germanic. Interesting. Okay. So, what's an example of a decisive sentence, a decisive informative? Do you understand? Now, I'm not going to talk about performatives anymore. I'm just saying there's another kind of sentence, but I'm not interested. The questions and the commands, who cares? Unimportant for our purposes. So an example of a decisive or an absolute would be a dog is a long-toothed canine. An indecisive sentence would be a dog could be long-toothed. The conditional tense of the verb shows it to be indecisive. It's not decided yet, is it? Undecided. Maybe I should say undecided instead of indecided. Undecided. Undecided. Undecided as opposed to decided. An imaginary sort of sense would be egos are in, or egos are good, egos are bad, egos are outrageous, egos are penguins. An example of a visible sort of informative is Joe's sitting in the front row. I don't know. This script, that's, I'm not sure what that, that's a slippery word, description. I didn't. I will. Very, very important word. As a matter of fact, I didn't crank out the revised. You got it last week's. It's got a few mistakes in it, but visible. If you translate that into Germanic, it's sight. Vide is Latin for see. And that's, and the Greek for that is idea. Eido. Idea. How about that?
So it's visible like an observation, or is it an idea?
Visible? Okay, if you're asking me for the Germanic word see, like see. See, I don't know about this up, serve, up, out, serve out. What are you talking about? You know what serve is in Germanic? Slave, slave.
Means I can verify with my eyes, observable.
There you got it, eyes, eyeballs. You can eyeball it. Now you got it. You see. You notice I don't have to tell you what the word see means. Huh? What? No, that's fine. As long as you realize that you are departing from the base, which is C, in a, and you're departing a long ways.
But some things are understood. I mean, the context.
Now I'm standing under the rope there. I'm glad you guys are saying these things because it's making the point. when we get into words like conceive, perceive, observe, fine Latin words, but how would you translate those words into Germanic? The answer is you don't know. You have to work a long time to figure out what in the hell those are in Germanic. And now, the farther you get away from your native tongue, the more variation in usage of a word. So you take, here's the home ground. See. Look at that up in a dictionary, and you'll find that they don't define it. If you don't know what that means, nobody can help you. Look it up. They'll say some silly things, but they can't define it. And I'll talk about what it is to define a word. Or let's say, they can't say what it means. Can't say what it means. And what they do say is funny. If you check out, you know, if they say, well, see, that means, look. No, it does not. No, well, then maybe it means observe. It does not. You know, okay, ring it around. Just trot out any words you want, any dictionary will do this. And you say no, 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 no. The point is, you can't say what a word means. That's what Korsitsky said way back. You cannot say what a word means. You can only point. Record. Tie again, huh? Tie again. Record.
Tie again. View with your eyes.
Huh?
View with your eyes.
View. Well, that's view is just one of the many forms of visible. View is a permutation of that word, which is the basic word here is vide. Very important word, extremely useful. I'll show you how useful that one is. But it's and I would say very meaningful. You don't need anybody to tell you what the word view means. It's you grew up with the word. Oh, you probably got it when you were 10 years old, maybe 12. Just like the word vision and visible. These came in your probably preteen years. I don't know, I haven't traced when these Latin words start coming into your vocabulary. You don't get them when you're 5 years old. Forget it. You get Germanic when you're five. Depends on where you're raised, but the Latin starts being fed into your vocabulary when you get older. Your native tongue is very, very guttural Germanic if you're raised in an English-speaking home. These words start getting salted into your vocabulary increasingly as you go up the grades. But back to the point that this is the base which anchors words like visible, vision. When you ask, well, what does vision mean? Well, I mean seeing. What does seeing mean? You don't know, I can't help you. You learn that when you're a little kid. It's native. It's natural. It's a quite a funny experience to trace back. Go to the Germanic words in the Oxford English Dictionary or any other dictionary. Oh, no, etymological dictionaries and the Oxford English Dictionary. What you find is when they get to the Germanic words, they don't say what they mean. They just say, well, seeing is seeing. You know, seeing is seeing. When they try to say what a word like see or seeing or sight means, they do silly things like substituting other words as the meaning. All right, take a look at those two words, to see and to look. What's the difference? They're not the same. They do not mean the same thing. Then you know, you ask yourself what the difference is. Don't you?
Look has purpose.
I say, do you see my watch? You know exactly what I'm talking about. Do you look my watch? No, that doesn't make sense, does it? Shows that the word look takes an object. You're doing it at the object. Seeing is more of a in the passive. Is it getting through to you versus are you getting through to it? They're opposites. They're very, very, they're in the same family. But notice the linguists, the language experts' mistake when he says that the meaning of the word see is the word look. That is not the meaning of the word see. No. Take any word you want to. Put them around here and say, that word means that. No, it doesn't. You got any more you want to say? Ogle, how about that? Well, see means ogle. Oh, no, it doesn't. How about perceive? You want to put that one there? Well, to see is to perceive something. It is not. Well, yeah. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. That is not its meaning. That is its equivalence, equal. That is its translation into Latin. Now we got it. So the translation of the word is not the meaning of the word. The meaning of the word is its usage. Okay, there is one thing that the idealists and the positivists agreed on. Both of them getting heavily into linguistics. The idealists and the positivists agreed on this. The meaning of a word is its usage in the language. Usage. You can't say what a word means. You can only show how it is used. But the minute you open your mouth and try to say what it means, you're going to put some other words down there, and that is not what it means. It doesn't mean words. It means something that you point to, something that you show. More mischief has come from this confusion between translation and meaning than is imagined, can be imagined. The translation of a word is not the meaning of a word. The meaning of the word cannot be said. That's what Korsitsky said a long time. You cannot say what a word means. You can only show, point, demonstrate. An id? You don't. A what?
Yeah.
An id. You don't. Can't. Or if, unless you can, I'd like to see this.
So it has a meaning?
sense that you can't, that in a sense,